imposter is not to be injured. Use minimum force. Repeat. The imposter is not to be injured.
Live in the USA and covering the whole wide world, this is the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Right on!
With Bob Seska and Chez Pazienza.
You don't understand. I've got proof. They need proof. I've seen it happening. They've got to tell people.
Tell them what?
The ocean's dying. Plankton's dying. It's people. Soylent Green is made out of people.
They're making our food out of people. Next thing, they'll be breeding us like cattle for food. You gotta tell them. You gotta tell them.
Promise, Tiger. I promise. I'll tell the exchange.
You tell everybody. Listen to me, Hatcher. You gotta tell them. Silent Breed is people!
The following podcast contains harsh language, nudity, graphic violence, adult situations, and a healthy obsession with empirical reality.
Hey.
The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show.
Two of the greatest over-actors in the history of American cinema.
I was going to say, did you go for just the hammiest guys you could find? If you put Sanchez in there, you'd have like Rick Sanchez. You'd have the fucking Marx Brothers of hamminess.
That's right. No, I didn't consider Rick Sanchez. I should have.
Not necessarily an actor, but trust me, having worked with him, he is kind of an actor.
Well, of course, we're going to be talking about Dylan Radigan here in a few minutes, because that was the reason for the William Shatner clip there at the beginning.
I'm thespian force of nature that is William Shatner.
That's right. You just can't beat it. I mean, yeah, I like to play on the show. I like to play the clip of Shatner Shatner as Kirk reciting the preamble to the Constitution. Which is the greatest, my most favorite clip of all time that I've ever played at the top of this show. And maybe I'll wheel it out later, maybe at the end of the show or something. But Soylent Green is People is a reference to Mitt Romney. We'll be talking about Mitt Romney in a minute. Hey, it's the Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show. I'm Bob Seska. That's Chez Pazienza over there.
And it is me.
Lots to talk about this week. I'm feeling kind of out of sorts a little bit, and I shouldn't. It's because I finally am sitting at a desk. For the first time in 7 months, I'm sitting at an actual wooden desk with full, screens in front of me and everything, instead of at a laptop.
Wow.
I've been conducting.
Do you have a band, a conductor that you can signal to, like Paul Schaefer, and the pencils you can throw and shit like that?
That's right. Not like a talk show desk, but just at a legitimate.
That would
sort
be
of
that would computer. If you were pulling like a Rupert Pupkin, that would be brilliant. I would love every just the image of you sitting there talking to an audience full of cardboard cutouts.
Ma,
right, yeah,
lower it. That's another great clip. I love that.
Yes,
I'll have to play that again sometime soon.
That's one of the best and most underrated movies, pretty much ever.
It really is, and no
absolutely
one
absolutely one of Scorsese's best.
That's exactly right. It's easily one of Scorsese's best. Here's the clip we're talking about. This is
now, Jerry. Before I begin, I just want to thank you for listening to this material and for the opportunity you've given me. You know, lots of people.
This is Robert De Niro sitting in his basement, pretending to carry on a talk show, like a late night talk show, like a Johnny Carson type show. And he's sending this tape, this audition tape, to the Jerry Lewis character, who's Jerry Lewis actually
Jerry Langford.
Jerry Langford, right? Playing like a Carson type. Right? And so he really believes he's the next king of comedy. He believes he's the next big successful late night talk show host. And
he becomes one, which is sort of, puts that movie about on par with Network when it comes to sort of prescience.
That's exactly right. So this is De Niro doing an audition tape for his late night talk show in his mom's basement.
People think that guys like you, you know, people who have made it, lose their feeling for struggling young talent, such as myself. But now I know from experience that those people are just cynics, embittered by their own failure. I know, Jerry, that you are as human as the rest of us, if not more so. Oh, well, I guess there's no point going on about it. You know how I feel. So let's get on with the show, The Best of Rupert Pupkin. Jerry, I've sketched out this little outline in order to save you a little bit of time, okay? It's a little introduction. So close your eyes and imagine it's exactly 6 o'clock. You're standing in the wings and we hear Lou Brown and the orchestra strike up your theme song.
Now he's queuing. He's queuing all these tapes now, right? He's got all the tapes laid out in front of him.
So it really is you. It's completely, that's like the snake eating its own tail right now. You're playing a tape of, you're doing a talk show, sort of, playing a tape of a guy pretending to do a talk show. You were pretending to do a talk show, quite frankly.
That's right. And you know, I'm just waiting for the Bubble Genius commercial so I can take my pencil and chuck it through the screen, you know.
Right.
Break the window in back of me. So, yeah. Mm. But anyway, this is, let's continue with this because this is too classic.
And now, from New York, it's the Jerry Langford Show with Jerry's guests, Richard Pryor, Ben Gazzara, Elizabeth Ashley, Carol Burnett,
and the comedy find of the year, making his television debut, Rupert Pupkin, the new
Rupert.
King of comedy.
Rupert, Mom. Are you crazy?
Say
what's
hello
the matter with you?
Jerry.
Ah,
Mom. People are sleeping. Lower it.
Lower it.
What's the matter with you?
Mom!
Take it easy. Lower it.
I'm not going to lower it. I have to do this now.
I don't mind you playing it, but lower it.
That's so great.
Scorsese's mom again, by
the
way.
That's right, yeah.
Yeah, from the same mom from Goodfellas.
Right, and we don't ever see her. She's just shouting right from upstairs, right, for him to lower it, and he's just...
Like Carlton, your doorman. As I really age myself by mentioning that I know who Carlton, your doorman is.
It's so great. I think it's Scorsese's only comedy. I mean, because it really is kind of a dark comedy.
Right. Oh, yeah, it is.
And he just, you know, throughout the entire movie, it's Sandra Bernhard and Robert De Niro just stalking the Jerry Lewis character. Best thing that Jerry Lewis has ever done, by the way.
Yeah, I can't argue with that.
But, you know, like, seriously, I'm at a real, like, computer desk. I just have a desk here with my computer sitting on it. I've got two computers, actually, and two monitors. But for the first time in 7 months, I actually don't – I'm not huddled over a laptop, which is how I've been doing the show. And so it's so much more comfortable, although a little bit, you know, a little bit strange. This is kind of an adjustment, so –
I actually have a live studio audience.
Or is
I hire a bunch of 12-year-old Peloponnesian prostitutes. Peloponnesians, do they even exist anymore? I don't think so.
Polynesians exist.
Polynesians. Well, you know, I don't want to. That's your market now that you're out in Hawaii.
Yeah, there are lots of Polynesians here.
God, oh, boo. Blew that joke.
Well, we got to get to... I wanted to mention the stock market real quick, because if you're just joining us and you haven't followed politics or current events today, the stock market was way up again. It was like up another, I don't know, 400 something points. So just to recap, the kind of market we've seen since the debt ceiling deal. Market was down on Monday, 620 points. It was up on Tuesday, 500 points. Down on Wednesday, 500 points. Up today, 400 points. I think from what I recall, they call that the dead cat bounce. It's like a horrible thing to call it, but unless you hate cats. But it's the dead cat bounce is what's happening. And I'm not sure what's going to happen tomorrow. No one knows. And yeah, I made this point on the blog the other day that if you turn on CNBC and you watch CNBC for any length of time, and I'm sure you have, Chess.
Yes.
It is wall-to-wall spazzy white guys. I mean, there might be seven of them at a time in seven individual windows on the screen. And these are the guys. And you watch it, and you turn on, and much like Glenn Beck, you can't watch it for any longer than maybe 10 minutes at the very most, because it will make your ears bleed. It'll make your head want to explode and your brain melt. if that's even possible. Mm. But when you see all of these guys on CNBC, you know, Jim Cramer and all of them, Larry Kudlow, the whole gang, Dylan Radigan used to be one of them. These are the guys who essentially have their fingers on the button of the American economy. These spazzy, hyperkinetic guys, and it's all, they do nothing but talking in a language that you can barely understand. It's all these crazy numbers and you know, just all kinds of speculation and weird language. All of it means this. They don't know what the hell they're talking about. It's all knee-jerk emotion. That's what's guiding the American stock market.
Right.
Bunch of people decide, oh, holy shit, and they freak out and they start throwing their poo around. Stock market goes down. And they say, oh, look, it's down. We can get a bargain. We can buy a bunch of stuff. So they buy it. Stock market climbs up again. They go, oh, God, it's too high. Whoa! And they freak out and it goes down again. Now, this is what we're seeing right now. There's no rhyme or reason to it other than it being an indicator that the people who are controlling our economy are freaking out because of all of these factors we've talked about for weeks on end here regarding the deficit and regarding stimulus and the state of the of economic growth and a recession. And I mean, it was like last week. It's just exhausting to know and to kind of get into why exactly all of these things are happening.
I think that their entire sort of the way that they broadcast is to try to get the point across to you of what it's like to actually be on the floor of the stock market with all the yelling and screaming. And I think the thing that you posted earlier in the week, which I was kind of waiting for somebody to do with the reference to trading places with Duke and Duke.
Yeah.
You know, that whole about how it's, you know, completely animalistic down there on the trading floor. Mm-hmm. I think that they watch that and they somehow think, you know what, that's the vibe we need to get across to America. Cause that's going to be trusted. The fact that, you know, people see all this sort of crazy yelling and screaming on the trading floor, and therefore they're going to really trust us if we do the same stupid, ridiculous shit being one guy in this studio.
You know, there was a period of time where I was watching CNBC a lot. It was before the recession. I decided to, you know, sort of dip my feet into the stock market thing. Yeah, I started buying a few stocks. I think I had like Sirius Satellite Radio at the time. You know, a couple of just I had Apple, you know, just like the stocks that I of the companies I really, really liked. And then, you know, like a couple of mutual funds because I had to diversify. That's what you're supposed to do. But so I was watching CNBC, so I just keep up with all that stuff. And it was remarkable to see how even it was manipulated by CNBC, how the market was actually – CNBC could actually have a say over how a particular stock does. If Cramer mentions Altria on his show and says, go and buy Altria, yada, 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 blah, blah. You know, and he does whatever he does with all his sound effects and spazzes out. Then, you know, almost immediately – the futures for, because what's it, Jim Cramer's on late at night. He's on like at 9 or 10 o'clock. As soon as he mentions that, whatever stock he mentions, the futures go way up. I mean, you just watch it in real time. Spikes way up. And then the next morning opens way up. So Jim Cramer can actually say, buy this stock, and then the stock goes through the roof. And it hangs on. And it does fairly well, continuing forward in time. But nevertheless,
and it's instantaneous now, which it didn't used to be. It used to be the kind of thing where, you know, you read about the stocks the next day, or you know you watch the news, or you watch the business report at 7 o'clock or whatever the hell it was.
Yeah,
and you know, and it wasn't the real time effect that you get now, which is, you know, like you said, one guy goes on CNBC, which, you know, there's CNBC, there's Fox Biz, and these people are on all day, and they say something, you know, they get on there and they make a pitch for a stock, or they say this is good or this is not good. And yeah, that has a real time immediate effect.
Yeah. And so it was just strange being in that atmosphere, having watched political cable news for so many years and then switching over to CNBC and seeing how that universe functioned, at least from a broadcasting point of view. And then going back, and then, you know, once the recession really, I started you know, obviously I watched both, but I was predominantly watching CNBC and then getting all my political stuff online. But then when I started going back to MSNBC and watching political, the contrast was remarkable. It seemed like, and I remember this very clearly, it seemed like Chris Matthews was speaking in slow motion. I mean,
which is really hard to imagine.
Right. But the culture, it was like a culture shock going back and forth between these two places. Now, I also want to mention, too, that, you know, Kramer, there is a famous YouTube clip. If you look it up on YouTube, there's a clip of Jim Cramer basically admitting to having manipulated the stock market. And so, you know, I watch all of this happening and I go, what could we ever possibly do to repair that? I mean, how do you put that? You can't unmake that omelet. You can't put that omelet back in the shell. It's already out there. And so how do you fix it? I have no idea. But this week, Dylan Radigan, who was one of those guys, and I still believe that he is. Dylan Radigan is still very, or sometimes I accidentally call him Dilligan. He is still one of those spazzy white guys in Lower Manhattan. Except
right,
now,
but he's jumped on the populist bandwagon.
Right, right.
And he's done it very, very well. I mean, look, let's face it. There, you know, I thought the same thing. Radigan for me for the longest time was, you know, spazzy white guy's a good term. I mean, he was one of those, you know, one of those asshole masters of the universe down there at down there in Lower Manhattan, changing the course of history, economic history for all of us, and making a lot of money as he does it, as far as I'm concerned.
No.
And, you know, and all of a sudden he turns around one day and starts writing pieces that are, you know, excoriating, the direction that the country is heading in and sort of biting, at least a little bit, biting the hand that feeds him. And I'm like, wow, you know, when the hell did, not to bring this up, but it was sort of like when Arianna Huffington suddenly became liberal.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, when did this happen?
I mean, don't get me wrong. Great broadcaster, smart guy.
He is actually a pretty good broadcaster, and he is obviously very bright. There's no doubt about it. But, yeah, I mean, look, he's a part of the generation of screaming people.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's what I guess they think gets their point across. I mean, you know, I'd rather hear people get upset about politics than I would hear people scream about the stock, you know, scream about, you know, buy this stock, buy that stock and pull up fucking Jim Cramer. Yeah. But yeah, there's no doubt about it. I mean, I watched his now viral rant, which was funny for a whole host of reasons. The first of which is, look, you know, some of what he said was good. You know, it is. And some of what he said is absolutely correct. But just from a sort of, objective standpoint, to take a step back, first of all, as he's yelling, I'm just looking at the people behind him in the newsroom and thinking to myself, they've got to be just thinking, what the fuck is this asshole doing? Why is he shouting on TV? And meanwhile, the two very nice women that he's talking to, they keep doing the cutaway shots of them, and they're sitting there like, this man is going to rape us. He is going to jump over unnecessarily large plexiglass desk and rape us.
I mean, yeah. I just kept thinking that he was gonna that they were looking at him, thinking he was gonna rip his shirt off and just do like again do that sort of Shatner as Kirk over dramatic, like knocking the computer monitor off the table and shoving the books off and running over to the mirror and bashing the mirror and screaming, "I'm Captain Kirk," and then just wondering how. This guy has invited us on his show. How do we respond to this? You know, he set this up with, you know, both sides represented, a Republican analyst, a Democratic analyst, and then suddenly wigs out and says, well, the problem is both sides. And, you know, the format contradicts everything that he was saying. And so therefore what happens is it comes off as disingenuous. I'll play a little bit of it here in case you haven't heard it yet. This is a little bit of the Dylan Radigan rant from, what was it, yesterday, day before?
Oh, so and who couldn't get the votes? John Boehner.
A big deal
Congress.
For what? What are you talking about? $4 trillion.
$4 trillion.
We owe $70 trillion.
I understand that. But
those
but you can't
to
sit
walk
here
out
and say,
a $4 trillion solution, okay, which is basically just a way for the Democrats to avoid dealing with this until 2017. I'm not here to talk about plans to deal with this.
Well, that's wrong. That's wrong. I mean, the Democrats don't want to cut anything. Democrats know that cutting anything is gonna wreck the recovery, but they're trying to compromise. They're not.
Till 2017. I'm saying we've got a real problem, and I'm tired of Republicans and Democrats who either want Republicans who want to burn the place to the ground, and Democrats, with all due respect, who want to offer a plan that gets it through the their end of their second term of their presidency, and then screws me and my kids when it's over. And until we do that, we have to deal with the extraction that is at foot. It is the reason the financial markets are behaving the way they're behaving. That is a mathematical fact. This is not some opinion.
Mathematical. Fat. Yeah,
I mean, I'm thinking to myself, you know, obviously I've been in journalism for a long time, which means that I know nothing about math, or you know, I can barely balance my checkbook, so I don't know any of the Wall Street terms. But extracted, do you know what he kept saying that over and over again? America is being extracted.
Yeah,
extracted from what?
Yeah, well, he's talking about investment overseas, moving jobs overseas,
gotcha.
Basically all the populist stuff. But then he also mixes in there some conservative populism. He's talking about tax rates. Tax rates are at a record all-time low. Tax rates for the wealthiest 1% are the lowest of any industrialized nation in the world. 35% is incredibly low. So, I mean, you can't make that case. I mean, and again, this speaks to the problem that I have with this feigned outrage. And make no mistake, this is, he's performing.
I mean, as I'm watching it, I just kept thinking to myself that he's, you know, I'm wondering if he either really gave it a lot of thought ahead of time, or if as he's going, he's sort of, you know, there's the little angel and devil on his shoulder, like an Animal House, saying, you know, oh, this is great. This is going to be a winner. You know, baby needs a new time slot.
That's right. That's right. And so, right. And so what he does is this is the kind of guy, spends a lot of time blasting how politics is discussed, how politics is done in America. He calls it pro wrestling. But then yet he orchestrates this freak as a Republican analyst.
He almost smashes somebody in the back of the head with a steel chair that's on fire.
That's right. He might as well be in a steel cage. He might as well be leaping off, you know, the top of the ladder with a fistful of barbed wire.
I'd actually like to see. I'd love to all of a sudden just hear, you know, the rock music come on, and the Rock comes out and just grabs him and beats the crap out of him.
Regardless, so what he does is, you know, he talks like this, and sometimes he'll say something, wow, you know, that's actually kind of smart, and then he'll bring in Andrew Breitbart and praise Andrew Breitbart, or he'll praise Paul Ryan, or he'll praise T. Boone Pickens to their faces on his show.
Well, you know, I mean, I actually don't have a problem with somebody whose politics are tough to pin down. That doesn't bug me. I mean, I think praising Breitbart is never really a good thing, because I think Breitbart's a raging lying tool.
But I'm saying he's contradicting himself with that. What he's doing is
that's the thing. Yeah, if you contradict your own politics, then that's, you know, if you're doing it just for the sake of you know, to sort of to try to sort of appeal to both sides and play the, you know, I'm apolitical thing. Then yeah, that becomes, you know, if you're contradicting yourself, that becomes an issue.
Yeah, I mean, that's right. So I mean, like,
you know, I tend to evaluate each issue on sort of its own merits, which means that there are some things that I'm conservative about. There are quite a few things that I'm, you know, liberal about. For the most part, I tend to go at least as close to the middle as I can. I'm very zen about that, But yeah, I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, I go out of my way to sort of make sure that I'm never, or at least try not to ever contradict myself. And yeah, you're right. If that's when it becomes a problem, if in your quest to sort of appeal to all sides, you're screwing yourself, your own politics over.
Yeah,
it's like literally saying, I hate pro wrestling. Here's Vince McMahon.
Right. So that's the Dylan Ratigan thing. If you want to watch the video, it's all over the place online. He just, you know, he freaks out, and what, you know, the content of the actual freak out is all over the place. Just these big broad stroke systemic things, and eventually it leads up to the president's got to get on TV and make a big powerful speech. It's like the same thing we hear.
It's the Drew Weston argument.
Yeah. I mean, it's just the same horseshit solution that everyone comes up with, even though the president has routinely gotten on television and made a big speech and tried to convince the American people. And then we say just words. He's just a bunch of words. He needs to do something instead of just words. So it's just, you know, it's the same. That was
Jonathan Chait. Did I pronounce that correctly? I've never actually heard it pronounced.
Yes.
Sort of smackdown of the Drew Weston piece that everyone was talking about in the New York Times. Basically, you know, a very good point he makes, which is that it's sort of a very liberal conceit to think that the president can make an impassioned that rhetoric is so powerful that it can absolve all the politics. You know, get rid of all the politics. It's funny. Ever since making the bad Peloponnesian comment, I just can't even think today. That's really awful. You know, I fucked up that. I went all the way back to like ancient Greece to make a crack. Failed fucking miserably. Fell on my goddamn face, and now I'm just all over the place. So, anyway, no,
you're right. I mean, Jonathan Chait. In fact, Fareed Zakaria wrote a piece in which he quotes Jonathan Chait. Every known impediment to the legislative process, special interest lobbying, the filibuster, macroeconomic conditions, not to mention certain settled beliefs of public opinion, are but tiny stick huts trembling in the face of the atomic bomb of the presidential speech.
Right.
It's not true.
It's cool because he references Aaron Sorkin, who obviously is somebody who's a really big fan of crafting these presidential characters who give these big impassioned speeches, and everybody just sort of trembles at the power of them.
Yeah.
And it just seems to me like a very sort of liberal thing to think. I'm not sure conservatives believe that. I think conservatives are much more cynical when it comes to that kind of thing. Or maybe it's just the fact that they, you know. Maybe each side believes whoever the hell it wants to believe, because God knows the conservatives lift up the Reagan speeches like it's, you know, like he was speaking the word of God. So I mean, what the hell do I know?
Well, I mean, is a big speech going to win over Ben Nelson? Is a big speech going to win over Eric Cantor? I do agree that I like the idea of big, stirring presidential speeches. From a broad stroke point of view, from a presidential historian kind of point of view, I like those grand gestures where the president gets out and behaves in a presidential way. I think one of the big mistakes of the Obama presidency, going back to day one, was, you know, he was slow to put his stamp on the presidency in those sort of kingly ways. Regardless of what we say about the president of the United States, we like a kingly president. That's just an historical point of view, regardless of whether or not we admit it, we like a kingly president. So we like the president to come in. We like the president to put a stamp on the Oval Office, have lots of pictures.
I do agree with Weston's point that there are things that he could have said. I don't know how much it would have changed the big picture, but there are things he could have said that I think America probably would very much have liked to have heard.
And the
sort of pretend speech, the storytelling speech that Weston says, you know, the hypothetical speech he mentions, it's a good one. You know, it's a fantasy. Mm-hmm. It really is. Almost no president would ever say something like that. Like Chait says, he has to go all the way back to FDR to basically find a president who was willing to sort of say things like that. And he draws the parallels between our time and the time when FDR came into office. And Chait kind of shoots that down.
Yeah.
But once again, that's like you said, it's a thing for presidential historians to debate back and forth. But, you know, I mean, it was interesting to me because Chait references, like I said a second ago, Chait references, Aaron Sorkin and sort of the presidential speeches, the pretend presidential speeches he wrote for, the dialogue for guys like Michael Douglas in The American President and, of course, Martin Sheen on The West Wing. And I thought that was funny because I always remembered the first time that I saw the American president. And I love that speech that that Michael Douglas gives at the end, where he's, you want to come at me, I'm Andrew Shepard and I am the president and that kind of crap. And everyone, Michael J. Fox is standing there and just is in absolute awe. I think he mentions the word erudite or something like that.
I was trying to figure out how to spell the word erudite.
Yeah. Right. Exactly. And it's funny because this may prove how cynical I am, but I remember the first time I saw that thinking, wow, that's interesting, because that's not at all what I would have I thought that was an impressive speech, but that's not at all what would have really happened in the real world. What would have happened is 2 seconds after that speech, the right would have ramped up and said, look at him, he's unhinged and he's angry.
Yeah.
Look at him. Look at how crazy he is. He's, we can't believe he, obviously the president is losing his shit. They would have been on every cable news network in the country saying that. Any camera they could get in front of. And that's the way it is now.
Yeah.
So really Obama, rhetoric doesn't mean as much as it used to. It's a beautiful thing. Like you said, it's in sort of the for posterity kind of thing. It's a gorgeous thing to behold. And I think it does have the ability to inspire people. Mm-hmm. There's no doubt about it. But I don't think it has the ability to actually affect major, major change.
Yeah.
Well, but look, if Weston was making the case that hey, look, just saying it kind of lets you know where Obama stands, because he tends to not do that a lot, then that I actually can't argue with that much. Because it's true. There have been times that I've wanted Obama to say flat out, this is what I'm about.
Yeah.
And I get disappointed when he doesn't. Doesn't mean I don't support him. Doesn't mean I don't think he's a bright guy. Just, it pisses you off a little bit.
Well, there's a common wisdom on the left that clouds an actual view of what this president is all about. And I believe this strongly. We are not, there's a collective thinking that is wrong about President Obama. This guy, in 2 years, he has made at least three speeches, three major primetime televised speeches, in which he has laid out the best case for the first time in decades, laid out the best case I've ever heard for liberal governing, for spending, for big government. This guy has done the legwork as far as speeches go. He's made grand speeches. We just tend to get wrapped up in all of the bread and circuses around it. We get wrapped up in what the pundits say afterwards. Maybe a Republican politician blurts out, you lie, in the middle of it, and we're all on top of that guy.
Right.
And it all gets lost. Now, again, sure, much to her credit, Rachel Maddow, who's a genius, has pointed these things out. But then again, they get lost. They get lost with, Dan Choi, and they get lost with, teleprompters and all the stuff we talk about on a regular basis here. It tends to obfuscate what the president has really been doing. And
the media are not interested in seriousness. They want silliness. Silliness is great TV. Silliness is page views.
That's right.
The more ridiculous things get, the more likely you are to draw an audience. It's that simple.
Yeah, the president got up in front of the American people to a joint session of Congress and gave a huge speech about health care. This was the fall of, 2010? No, 2009. Mm. And what do we remember from that speech? We remember that dude from wherever, Carolina, South Carolina, shouting out.
Is it South Carolina? I can't remember.
Yeah. It was Joe Wilson.
I got a 50-50 chance.
It's one of those. Had to be. Let's just say it's South Carolina.
It's one of the Carolinas.
Because all the crazy people.
Is it the one with south of the border, or the one with Duke?
Yeah, it's just the place where the biggest thing in South Carolina is south of the border, along 95 there. I love that place. Only because of
which shitty thing does it feature? South of the border or Duke?
Well, so this guy, Joe Wilson, shouts out, you lie, and that's what we remember from that speech. We don't remember the fact that he gave this huge impassioned plea, this summation at the end that says, you know what, government can do good things, government can spend and help the American people. Just laying out a case for progressive liberal governing. And we forget these things.
I think what it comes down to for liberals, and this is the both sides do this. I think liberals do it more because of the fact that conservatives tend to stay on message and stay together, even with the schism that the Tea Party has brought. They tend to stay on message better than liberals. And you and I have talked about this, you know, till we're blue in the face. I think that kind of like I think Chait made this point about the Westin piece. We liberals or anyone center left tend to project onto our leaders what it is that we want to see.
Yeah.
You know, like I said, I think it barely matters for conservatives. I really do. I think that they're going to sort of fall in lockstep regardless, because for them, the big picture is, you know, the most important thing. But, you know, and I've said this, oh my God, I've written about this more times than, you know, there are progressives, liberals, centrists out there who more actually, I think, progressives, you know, people on the left and quote unquote far left, who really sort of projected their fantasy onto Obama and thought, you know, when this guy comes in, he's going to make gay marriage mandatory, and the military is going to be abolished, and a giant cruelty-free food co-op is going to be built on Ground Zero. That's all going to happen within the first 3 days of Obama being president.
Yeah.
And, you know, and of course that's not going to fucking happen. He's a centrist Democrat. He never pretended to be anything else. Yes, he sold hope and change, and I, you know, I believed him, and I still, you know, call me naive, but I still in a lot of ways do. I think he's had the shit beat out of him by the realities of what it's like going up against the people that he has no choice but to go up against. But, you know, that's always one of my biggest complaints when it comes to the left, is that it really projects whatever it is that it feels the candidate should be, and just beats the shit out of him or her if they don't get what they want.
Yeah. Well, I don't.
For a conservative, I got to believe that it's as easy as saying, look, I love Jesus, I don't want to raise your taxes, and you know, fuck those welfare queens. And that's it. You're one of us. You're a member of the Todd Browning Freaks. You're good. You're in the club, Rusty.
Well, I want to disagree with you on one thing. I don't think he's a centrist. I think he's a pragmatist. And we get those things confused a little bit. I think at heart, Barack Obama is absolutely a progressive.
Has Glenn Greenwald kicked in your front door yet?
No, listen, but you know what?
Listen for that knock at the door. That's him.
Yeah, I know. If you read his books, that's all you need to do. I mean, it's all right there. You know, this guy is not a centrist. He's a pragmatist. He knows the way government works, and he knows the slowness of it all. And he understands how change occurs in America, and it doesn't happen overnight. It certainly doesn't happen during a slow recovery from a brutal recession. Right. It's just not the way it happens. You don't pass sweeping healthcare reform in one, you know, big massive thing that turns everything around and completely obliterates our healthcare system. It doesn't happen. It's by small moves, and that's what you do. And regardless, he's done some remarkably progressive things, given, you know, that pragmatic point of view. And so I think what we end up doing is I think since the primaries, since the Clinton Obama battle during the 2008 primaries, I think what that left a lot of people with is sort of a hand on your hips, kind of, well, let's impress me now. You got to impress me. You know, it's like that. You know, it's like people who go to a concert and stand in the front row or sit in the front row with their arms folded and go, okay, now entertain me. Mm-hmm. So anyway, show as always brought to you by Bubble Genius at www.bubblegenius.com.
Still haven't given them my address yet.
Yes, I have not. Have you emailed me your address? I got to get your address.
I haven't. No, I have to.
Because they're.
No, I don't. I don't have an address. I live out of a Winnebago. Travel from place to place. Me and my Spartan hookers.
They're dying to send you soaps so you can scrub down your hookers.
My hookers. Yeah, I'm just gonna. I'm gonna keep doing callbacks on that fucking Peloponnesian line. I hate myself for that. Later on in life, I'm going to be, you know, what was the stupidest thing you ever said? Oh, I made a crack about Peloponnesian hookers. It's wonderful. Went over very well.
Well, see, I was going to maybe cut that out of the show for you, but now that you've mentioned it several times afterwards.
It's like you're bringing it back.
It's impossible to excise it from the show at this point. So.
That's all right.
Yeah, anyway.
Well, Welcome to a Bubble Genius.
Hi, I just heard it was National Resurrect Romance Week, and I thought it would be cute to get something cool for my boyfriend. Can you help me out?
I can show you sexy time.
Okay, then I'm just gonna, I thought this was a Bath and Body Shop.
Here is a sexy time.
What? Wow! Massage oil and powder? Edible? Oh, its name is Sexy Time.
Sexy Time!
My boyfriend's gonna love this.
And sexy time for you too.
Sexy time for me too. Thanks for spicing up my life with more fun products, Bubble Genius.
BubbleGenius.com. Sexy time.
Shove Bob and Chez into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go. Bubbles. Subscribe to the Bob and Chez Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
Right, you know, they want me to wait for the bubbles on those commercials, but when there's like a 5-minute gap between the last word and the first bubble, right. I think, well, God, they forgot the bubbles. And then
Who are those girls?
anyway, put in your promo code AWESOME, AWESOME, and get 15% off your entire order from BubbleGenius.com. It's the best goddamn soap ever in the whole world ever.
I just called them girls, which really says everything you need to know about me. That at the age of 41, I'm still referring to like women as girls. That tells you that I will never fucking grow up.
You're like
so pathetic.
You're like a 1930s band leader. We're gonna have girls, bring in the girls.
Yeah,
girls, bring it in. There's gonna be girls.
Hey, dames.
Dames, bring in the dames.
Bring in the dames.
Bring in the broads. See, we're gonna have broads on the show. Yeah.
Shit. Yeah. So, give me a grapefruit I can stick in somebody's face.
Well, speaking of misogyny. We were talking about the Bachman photo, the Michelle Bachman photo on the cover of Newsweek.
Yeah.
Evidently, that's misogynist. That's sexist. That photo, and I don't know exactly why.
I don't know if it's sexist. I think it was a bad idea. I mean, look, you know, my first reaction to it was, of course, to laugh my ass off, and to think that really it does capture Michelle Bachman perfectly it's a perfect snapshot, really. Mm-hmm. But yeah, of course, it's wrong. I mean, you know, the woman certainly has Tina Brown's argument that they took a bunch of pictures and that's really the best one they had is just fucking ridiculous. Of course they have other pictures of her and they could have gone with any one of those and they should have, because now, you know, now they've drawn, I mean, granted it sells magazines, which is great for Newsweek, but you know, now they've drawn a lot of unnecessary attention to Bachman, and to be honest, she played her cards right by basically just shrugging the whole thing off.
Yeah.
Which is the very smart thing to do. I actually, you know, while it's really easy to compare her and Sarah Palin, I actually don't think Sarah Palin would have done that.
No.
I think Sarah Palin would have jumped on it and, you know, tweeted about it and put crap up on Facebook about, you know, Newsweek and whatever. And Bachman was pretty much bright enough to just say, you know what, screw it. I'm not going to hassle with that.
All that said, I did find the perfect music for it. I don't know if you have the photo up on your screen.
I do not.
But if you're listening to the show, pull the photo up and just look at it. And I'm going to play.
Okay. I like this, giving everybody out there in podcast land the chance to do this too.
This is audience participation. I'll give you a second to pull up that photo of Michelle Bachman.
Let's see. Okay. Hold on a second. Newsweek. And I've got it.
Okay.
Larger than life.
Yeah, larger than life. Nope. It's just huge. Fill up the entire screen, and if there was sound that went along with a magazine,
all right,
cover.
You need to do this quickly because I'm staring into her eyes, and I'm this like I'm going to zone out in a minute. I'm being hypnotized by it.
Here's the sound that photo makes.
Yeah, pretty much.
It just keeps going.
Please stop. Make it stop. Please, I want off this ride.
So that's the sound.
Love Tommy Christopher at Mediaite's comment was great that people who got that magazine must have thought that they'd subscribed to It Puts the Lotion in the Basket Weekly.
Right. Oh, it's so great. And, you know, we were picking on
picking on Dylan Radigan before, Dilligan, and you know, MSNBC's answer to Shatner as Kirk. And I wanted to mention this. I want to play this clip. Just play this. This guy, I recorded this clip just for you. This is for you, Chez.
Okay. Oh, great.
Here we go.
Really declared war on collective bargaining and working people. Tonight is the measure of whether the country begins in the state of Wisconsin a national drive to push back, or whether we have more to go to build a movement of resistance. But resist we much. We must and we will much about that be committed.
I just get douche chills every time I hear that. It's like I have to turn away. I actually, the first time I heard that, I only listened to it like a half a second at a time, because it's so painful. It's so utterly cringe inducing to listen to.
Right. I mean, they might as well have brought in this guy.
Hoosiers are on the four on the year, and they have won six of its last seven games. Tomorrow will be the game three at 3 p.m.
Boom goes the dynamite. Switching
to Ball State men's tennis, it seems last week player on. It seems every week they have a player. Matt Lawrence is the latest Cardinals tennis player to win the award. Lamar won all the singles and doubles matches last week. So far, the Cardinals have had a player honored on the weekly awards. Seven out of the nine.
So you know what I mean. It's very good.
No, that's exactly what it is. And you know something? I know that they're not thinking this. I know that, but my mind also goes to the idea that doesn't it sort of seem like by putting Sharpton on the air, if some decision was made behind the scenes to correct the problem of not enough people of color on MSNBC's prime, you know, prime time or prime air, which basically would be 6 o'clock, any time like that. You know, if a decision was made to do that, isn't it kind of offensive and insulting to say, you know, well, any black person will do. Yeah. You know, it really. They're, you know, any black person will do. So fuck it. Let's bring in Sharpton. He'll work. He's perfect.
Yeah.
It's like, get somebody with talent, for God's sake.
Well, it doesn't help to have someone who it just flubs his way through an hour. It hurts the idea of liberal broadcasting. We have an uphill battle as it is, because
that's
liberals
fucking up too. Yeah. I mean, he quite frankly sounds like that a lot of the time. That's just a drastic fuck up.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for liberals to work on television and on radio, they have to be super sharp. I mean, they have to be like Tom Hartman's great example. Rachel Maddow's great example.
Great.
I mean, these guys are sharp as tacks, and they can just bite right through any obstruction that's put in their way, whether it's a Republican analyst on their show or, you know, just they can do a flawless hour or 3 hours. You can't pin anything on them. It's just fantastic.
I think
broadcasting.
A couple weeks ago, we talked about this, and I'm of the opinion that hire every single person from the nation. You know, give Melissa you're desperate for somebody who is a face of color on television. Give Melissa Harris-Perry a gig. She's great.
Miles Eric Dyson was really good the other night too. I think he filled in for Ed Schultz.
Yeah, he's always, you know, Dyson's always good. Bring in Ari Melber. Bring in Katrina. Bring in, you know, any of these people are all terrific. You know, if you're desperate, if you're really looking for somebody who leans progressive and will not embarrass you on air, then go with those people.
Yeah. And, you know, I always mix up Dyson with the guy from Terminator 2, Miles Bennett Dyson, the inventor of Skynet.
Dyson.
That's what I was saying.
Yes, Michael Eric Dyson actually created Skynet.
Miles Bennett Dyson, the inventor of Skynet. Yeah. Instead, we get for an hour in lieu of Jank, we get
and boom goes the dynamite.
Right.
Right.
Right. And it's, you know what? I mean, just giving him the benefit of the doubt. It's hard to read off a prompter, but he's been doing this for a couple of months now. And, you know, like today on his show, he was talking about, he led off the show with this big rant and then, you know, a roundtable discussion about something that really deserved about 1 second of time. You say,
kind of like this.
This is stupid. Right. This is stupid. Well, you know, we're critics of the media. We're allowed to talk about this stuff.
Right.
But, you know, Mitt Romney said off the cuff, which is always dangerous for him, he said that corporations are people.
Right.
And, you know, it's ridiculous. It's typical of Mitt Romney. It's typical of the Republicans. It doesn't deserve a whole, well, just because Mitt Romney thinks corporations are people, are corporations really people? I want to know what you think, America.
It's a funny thing to say, and it's certainly, I put it up today. It's definitely, and there's an argument to be made that certainly it's telling, but that obviously he just spoke very sort of inartfully, for lack of a better term.
And I'm not
what he was trying to say.
I'm not forgiving him for this. I think it was again very revealing of the Republican point of view. But right. It doesn't deserve a whole long thing. Sharpton did his whole opening segment about it. And you go, good Lord, it doesn't deserve that, but what it is it's just red meat, and it's the sort of thing that Ed Schultz and Dylan Radigan do all the time. They latch on to something that's kind of inconsequential, revealing and odd, and you say one thing about it and you move on, but not worthy of a whole outraged rant about it. It just doesn't deserve it.
Pick your battles.
Yeah,
exactly. Pick what you get indignant about.
Right.
Because otherwise you come off like a cartoon, like a caricature. And once again, Sharpton is the world's biggest caricature. That's, he always has been. Right. The shit he gets angry about, sometimes it's worth getting angry about. But a lot of times it's not. And it becomes a big deal when he enters the fray. Exactly. So Romney said something stupid and kind of said something that we all sort of know Republicans feel. There was no, there's no real gotcha moment there.
Yeah. Well, what happens is that gets focused on, and then we lose some serious things. Like you talk about the presidential field. I don't think Mitt Romney's got a chance in hell if Rick Perry gets in, and Rick Perry looks like he's getting into the race. Well, Rick Perry, this is news. Rick Perry took $72,000 in farm payments between 1987 and 1989, and an additional $9,600 for leaving his land to, not do anything. So he's taken all kinds of farm subsidies. His father received $6,400 from cotton and wheat subsidies in 2002 and 2003. This guy's taking welfare, basically. He's taking government handouts. And it doesn't get... He's sucking off the government tit. He's taking all this stuff and then blasting, making his political hay, making his name over blasting government spending. This is the kind of stuff. You want to do an opening rant about something, Al. You do an opening rant about this. It was Mitt Romney blabbing, making a two-second statement at a rally.
Right. The Romneytron 1000 fucking something up is not that big a deal.
That's right.
I hear stories from friends of mine who work behind the scenes still at MS, and some of whom work work not with Rachel Maddow, but with some of the people who work with her. And, Maddow is a pain in the ass. And she's a pain in the ass to them, supposedly, because she's – when I say pain in the ass, I don't mean that she's mean or anything like that. I just mean she's thorough. And she guides the coverage. She knows what she wants. She digs deep. She forces her producers to step up because she is at the forefront of that show. I cannot imagine, and I could be wrong about this, but I cannot imagine Sharpton leading that show, whatever show he's on. I cannot imagine him saying, this is what I want to do, this is how I want to do it, and this, and once again, I could be totally wrong about that, but as somebody who's not a broadcaster and not a producer and doesn't have any experience being on television or being a journalist, I can't see him standing there with a team full of people and not being sort of led around a little bit.
Yeah.
Because, everybody knows the reality of producing for somebody who's a quote-unquote star, which is you do all the work for him. I'm not saying he's lazy or that he doesn't do his work. I'm just saying that, when it comes to actually the meat of the show, I cannot imagine that he really has his fingers seriously, seriously, seriously into it.
Yeah. Well, it also requires a little bit of judgment in terms of what's news and what's not. What's a footnote?
That's it, exactly. He's got handlers.
Yeah. I mean, what's a footnote and what's the meat of deserving an entire segment? For example, you know, Rick Perry's getting the race. I was mentioning before about the money he's taken in farm subsidies, basically the government welfare that Rick Perry has taken, accepted. It wasn't foisted upon him. He took it.
Right.
He took it and then has made his entire political career on the national stage about, you know, opposing government so vociferously that he wants Texas to secede from the United States. And now he's going to be running for president of the United States, inexplicably. Those things,
you know, the interesting thing about that, though, is that, and you and I have talked about this, you know, for the very first time, it almost wouldn't, you know, it may matter to a certain group of people. Certainly if you get a substantial media voice that's loud enough, if you get everybody kind of covering the story. But for the most part, the people Rick Perry is trying to appeal to, they'll never hear that story anyway. They won't. Fox will not cover it. Mm-hmm. Fox won't mention that, you know, that he took farm subsidies. And if he, you know, he has his own bullhorn with them. And, you know, in other words, you and I have talked about this. It's all of the sort of partisan, not just the partisan networks anymore, the partisan media outlets, but I mean, even the centrist ones now, they're kind of preaching to the choir. You know, I mean, all Perry is interested in, I guarantee you, is the audience that Fox News has, and it's a pretty big audience. And Fox will basically do whatever. Fox will line up to get on their knees and blow him and anything he has to say. And if any other media outlet says something negative, brings up the fact that he took he took a government handout and exposes that hypocrisy, all they'll do is say, you know, the liberal media attacking Rick Perry, and everybody who watches Fox and doesn't watch anything else, they'll fall right in line.
Yeah, that's true. This is from I believe this is from The Atlantic. Texas was the state that depended the most on stimulus money and actually balanced its budget. Rick Perry balanced his budget with stimulus money. That was the stimulus was why he was going to secede. Texas, which crafts a budget every 2 years, was facing a $6.6 billion shortfall for its 2010-2011 fiscal years. It plugged nearly all of that deficit with $6.4 billion in Recovery Act money. Right? $6.6 billion shortfall, received $6.64, just like $200 million less than they actually needed, stuck that in, balanced their budget. Leaving their quote-unquote rainy day fund untouched. They didn't use their rainy day fund for that. They used our money. They're
supposedly doing better than most of the country thanks to it.
Right. They used redistributed wealth. Rick Perry, the conservative savior, the guy who's very likely, as far as I'm concerned, very likely to win the Republican nomination as sort
of
a...
He's got Jesus on his side.
Yeah, well, I mean, he's got the Tea Party on his side, too. And this is the guy...
Same thing.
Right. This guy takes stimulus money, billions and billions of it, $6.6 billion to balance his budget, then gets up on a stage and says, I want to secede. I think we could secede from the United States. Yeah, you could do. Oh, and by the way, I think this is all socialism. Wrong. I don't think there should be a stimulus plan, you know, and then takes that kind of money. It turns around and takes that money. I balanced the budget. I worked my magic, and I didn't raise any taxes. Well, you know what? You balanced the budget with stimulus money, you hick. That's exactly
yeah, George Will made a great comment this past Sunday where he said that the inadvertent best comment of the week, where he said that Rick Perry was going – that if he was going to run, he's going to run on a platform of Texas exceptionalism. Okay.
Right.
Have you been to Texas? Have you seen what the fuck comes out of Texas?
Right. And there's more. You know, there's Michelle Bachmann taking earmarks. There's Rick Santorum taking earmarks. All these guys take government money. They've all got their fingers in the redistribution of wealth pie. You know, and then they'll spend the next couple of years running, you know, the next year and a half running against wealth redistribution. You know, it'll be all the entire...
Yeah, Maddow's really, really terrific show last night, her segment where she basically, you know, sort of dovetailing with a Steve Bannon piece, I think it was,
yeah,
where she basically said the best thing to do is just give all these people, all these Republican, all these Republican candidates and Republican politicians who have asked for stimulus money, who have basically put it in writing, just give it to them. Just rubber stamp it. Say, yeah, you know what, here you go. Here, and this is going to create jobs because you said it'll create jobs. And once we do that, you know, you can't make the argument. I say you can't make the argument. Of course, you can make the when you have no shame, you can make any argument.
Exactly.
But, you know, logically, you can't make the argument that, well, look, it'll bring the stimulus money will bring jobs to my district, but it won't work for the entire country.
Right. Florida Governor Rick Scott crashed into office earlier this year on a campaign bashing President Barack Obama's health care plan and its ability to lower costs for consumers. But it turns out that he doesn't mind the government twist that allows him to pay a lower insurance premium himself. This is from Raw Story. Scott pays only $30 per month for taxpayer-subsidized health insurance for himself and his family, the Miami Herald reported. Meanwhile,
Scott's such a fucking douchebag.
The janitors who clean his office in the state capitol pay six times as much out of pocket for their own health coverage. For the same family health plan that Scott pays $30 for, rank-and-file state employees pay $180 per month. Florida has one of the highest rates of uninsured people in the country. Socialism. That's what that is. Socialized medicine. Rick Scott, Florida, Republican Florida governor, Gollum himself, is receiving socialized medicine. $30 a month in taxpayer subsidized health insurance for himself and his family. It's not just himself. His family's getting all this too. And yet we're not allowed to have it. We're not allowed to, because it's socialism for us. If it's us, it's socialism. For him, it's okay.
But if you want, Rick Scott will let you take a ride in the Close Encounters mothership with Roy Neary, if you want.
Oh man, that's right. He does look like that gangly alien.
He does. Yes, he does.
That
alien was benevolent, though. That's the only difference.
That's true. The Bubble Genius Bob and Chez Show, brought to you exclusively by BubbleGenius.com. Pure products, pure genius. Bubble Genius, the best soap in the world. And I almost lost track of their commercial. Here's a new commercial.
Welcome to a Bubble Genius.
Hi, I just heard it was National Resurrect Romance Week, and I thought it would be cute to get something cool for my boyfriend. Can you help me out?
I can show you sexy time.
Okay, then I'm just gonna, I thought this was a Bath and Body Shop.
Here is a sexy time.
What? Wow! Massage oil and powder? Edible? Oh, its name is Sexy Time.
Sexy Time!
My boyfriend's gonna love this.
And sexy time for you, too.
Sexy time for me, too. Thanks for spicing up my life with more fun products, Bubble Genius.
BubbleGenius.com. Sexy time.
Shove Bob and Chez into your pants and haul them around with you wherever you go. Subscribe to the Bob and Chez Show in the podcast section on iTunes.
Put in your promo code AWESOME, AWESOME, and get 15% off your entire order from BubbleGenius.com. They're in the process of moving into their new lab. So I don't think they're shipping any orders for the next several weeks. But if you place your order now, they'll be the first out of the gate.
National Resurrect Romance Week or something like that?
Yeah.
Is that for real?
Is that what they said? Yeah, I think so.
I'll have to go get a blowjob then. Does that qualify as romance? It does in my book these days.
In Florida,
I'll have to go. I'll have to go get married again for the fourth time.
So this, we're running out of time here, but we want to talk about this CNN poll real quick.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, CNN. A lot of anger seems directed toward the GOP. According to the new survey, favorable views of the Republican Party dropped 8 points over the past month, 33%. 59% say they have an unfavorable view of the Republican Party, an all-time high dating back to 1992 when the question was first asked. The poll indicates that views of the Democratic Party, by contrast, have remained fairly steady, with 47% saying they have a favorable view of the Democrats and an equal amount saying they hold an unfavorable view. So Steve Bannon put together a great chart that kind of analyzes both of the or all of the poll results side by side. Democrats, you know, you see the favorable, unfavorable, equal height. Republican Party, favorable, way low, unfavorable, way high. Tea Party, favorable, way low, unfavorable, way high. So the Republicans at this point, is one of these moments where you kind of wish the election was tomorrow.
I wrote something about it today because, I mean, I sort of pegged it off of not just this survey, but one of the things that really has came to bother me over the last few weeks was the number of times that politicians on both sides. This is one of those times when I can say both sides. I think it's worse for Republicans because they're more full of shit. But whenever you hear a political leader invoke the will of the American people and say, this is what the American people want. Really, fuckwit? You sure about that? You know, I mean, we're so polarized now that almost nobody can speak for the whole of the American people. But obviously my point was, you know, pegging it off of this survey, the Republicans are completely full of shit when they say that. When they say, well, we're doing the will of the American people. No, you're not. The American people want you to essentially, you know, bring in revenue by raising taxes on the rich and closing loopholes and closing corporate tax breaks. And, you know, they're speaking about that loud and clear. You're not doing the will of the American people. You're doing the will of the people you've always been beholden to, which is, you know, the fringe and your sort of corporate, very, very wealthy overlords.
Well, what they can do is completely do an end around when it comes to any poll. I mean, there's just all of the polls leading up to the debt ceiling deal said that, you know, people really don't care about the deficit as much as they do about jobs and the state of the economy. People want stimulus. They want jobs. That's what every poll is saying that. But you'd never know that. You'd never know that listening to the Republican Congress.
That's what I mean. They flat out ignore it. It's a complete disconnect from reality.
Yeah.
You know, we're the American people, once again, that ever elusive, gigantic entity that is the American people. The American people are tired of the deficit. No, they're not. They don't give a fuck about the deficit. They care about how they're going to put, you know, food on their table next week or tomorrow.
And what they can do then is they use the deficit and the debt to confuse people. So therefore, I think people, when they get confused about something, they get scared, and then they tend to give something a little more importance than it actually deserves. So I think there are a lot of people walking around, for example, who don't know the difference between the deficit and the debt, and they see $13.5 trillion. Which is the national debt right now. And they think that's the deficit. And then they think, and then they hear President Obama say, well, you know what? The national deficit was over $1 trillion when I took office. It was $1 trillion when you took office, and now it's $13.5 trillion? Oh my God, holy shit. But that's not the case. They're confusing the deficit, which is in the $1 trillion range, $1 to $2 trillion, and the debt, which is much, much higher. And not necessarily as important as the deficit. Yeah, this is funny, all confused, and I guess we got to focus on this because it's enormous.
Exactly. It would be funny if the Republicans were more honest about it. If they just said, look, you know what? We need to concentrate on this debt problem and this deficit issue, because obviously that's going to be a huge problem for your children. And you know why you need to worry about that? Because we fucked you so bad, there's no hope for you. Just give it up. The best you can do now is hope that you can save something for your kids. So that's why we're concentrating on doing something that will help your kids later on, because you guys are fucked.
Right. Yeah. I mean, there's just... It gets so aggravating to even have a discussion about these issues because the facts have been so co-opted by lies, by nonsense.
Of course.
Where you say this is a job killing bill, or when it's not, when stimulus actually creates jobs. It gets so tremendously frustrating. But that's why we're here. We're here to offer some sort
of... I'm here to trip over my tongue when discussing prostitutes and ancient wars between Sparta and Greece. Or Athens, whatever the hell it was.
Well, you know, what we try to do is offer some sort of reality here. I mean, certainly we're, you know, we have lots to say, and some of it's a little over the top. But I think what we try to do
in the darkness,
we try to ground everything in intellectual honesty. We at least try to be, you know, I'm always seeking out the numbers that are the most accurate. I don't care where they come from. I don't care if they come from the Atlantic or the New Republic or, you know, Fareed Zakaria or George Will, for that matter. For you.
Right.
If they're accurate, and if I see, you know, verification all over the internet and various sources that makes those numbers valid, then those are the numbers I'm going to use. But thanks for listening. Thanks for tuning in. Drive safely. And Chez, cool. We'll talk to you next week.
Yep, absolutely. Bye, everybody.
And boom goes the dynamite.